This is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from national and international perspectives. We are your hosts, Doug Nesbitt
and Andrew Stevens.
On this week's show, we discuss recent reports on wealth inequality in North America. We also air Mario Savio's famous speech at UC Berkeley in late 1964 during the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, a seminal moment linking the question of civil rights to organized labor and the modern student movement in post-secondary education. But first, here's this week's labor news update.
The Canadian federal government has passed back-to-work legislation for 8,600 Air Canada mechanics, baggage handlers, and ground crew, and 3,000 pilots. The legislation sends the dispute to binding arbitration, bringing an apparent end to a labor dispute between a private employer and the unions representing its workers. Dave Ritchie, head of the Canadian section of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, representing the 8,600 mechanics and ground crew, denounced the legislation as an attack on workers' rights. Lisa Raitt, federal minister of labor, announced the government's intention to pass the legislation on March 8th, when Air Canada delivered an ultimatum to the unions that they agree to their so-called final offer or be locked out. The union responded a day later with a demonstration of several hundred in Pearson Airport's Terminal 1. The Conservative government justified the exceptional and heavy-handed legislation as necessary to protecting the economy. The legislation comes on the heels of similar threats against Air Canada flight attendants last summer, as well as back-to-work legislation against the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, who were locked out by Canada Post. Stay tuned to future episodes of Rank and File Radio for more on the implications of this legislation.
On Tuesday, March 13th, the 750 striking workers of Halifax Transit voted in favor of accepting a five-year contract, bringing an end to a six-week strike. Halifax Regional Council also voted in favor of the contract 19-2. In exchange for a $4,000 signing bonus, the workers receive a 2% raise in each of the first 4 years of the contract. However, ground was conceded on the question of rostering. There was also a rollback in wages for new hires. The union had rejected a city offer in late February by 78%.
Members of QP Local 3902, Unit 1, voted 67% in favor of ratifying the tentative settlement. QP 3902, Unit 1, represents teaching assistants and graduate and postdoctoral instructors at the University of Toronto. The negotiations between 3902 and the employer had experienced some setbacks when discussions broke down between the two parties in December of 2011. James Nugent, the former chairperson for Unit 1, resigned earlier this month from his position, citing disagreements with other members of the union's bargaining committee. Nugent was opposed to the university's latest offer. One of the most contentious issues was the size of tutorials and labs. Part of the settlement includes the establishment of a joint working group on undergraduate tutorials to be co-chaired by the union to make recommendations about the quality of teaching. Members of the bargaining unit will receive an average wage increase of 1.5% retroactive to May 2011 and a 2% increase in 2013. The average annual increase in revenue to the union and its members over the next 3 years will be 4.3%.
The International Labour Solidarity Network, Labour Start, has launched a campaign to stop the execution of Abdulreza Ganbari, a 44-year-old lecturer of Payam-e-Noor University in Iran. Ganbari was arrested at his home on January 4, 2010. He was charged for receiving unsolicited emails from an armed opposition group to which he does not belong. The professor was interrogated for 25 days and forced to confess under duress to unproven charges. Ganbari has no known political connections. He was previously involved in teacher union activities until his union, ITTA, was dissolved in 2007. His death sentence was confirmed by Tehran's appeals court in April of 2010. Education International, the world's largest federation of unions, representing 30 million education employees in over 170 countries, calls on the Iranian authorities to stay the execution of Professor Ganbari and revoke the death sentence. The organization, in partnership with Labor Start, is also calling for the Iranian authorities to drop charges against all detained trade unionists and for their immediate release. Information about the campaign can be found at www.laborstart.org.
According to a recent article that appeared in Labor Notes, when President Obama signed a bill on February 22nd that extended unemployment benefit eligibility and lowered the Social Security payroll tax by 2%, a virtually unanimous, bipartisan attack on public workers went largely unnoticed. Warren Davis, a retired vice president of the American Federation of Government Employees, authored the article that highlights the AFGE's silence over President Obama's decision to force federal workers to take a $15 billion pension hit on top of 2 years of pay freezes for the nation's 2 million federal employees. While Democrats have opposed Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's anti-union legislation, at the federal level, the party is leading its own assault on pay and benefits for government workers. Top union officials across the country still remain committed to their support for the Democratic Party and President Obama. As workers from the public and private sector face layoffs, cuts to pension and benefits, and wage rollbacks, their union representatives at the highest level refuse to challenge organized labor's historic political alliances. Leading into the 2012 presidential election, Obama depends on support from organized labor, just as he did in 2008. There is, however, a disconnect between the leadership and the rank-and-file membership, as Davis's article highlights.
Further up the road!
Further up the road!
Further up the road!
Further up the road!
Over 100 leaders and members of the Communication Workers of America took part in a march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama last week. CWA President Larry Cohen and other senior officials also joined the march. Marchers slept in churches along the way until they arrived in Montgomery on March 9th. A demonstration on the steps of the state capitol marked the end to the event. Cohen, along with civil rights and Latino activists and leaders, and others fighting against the new assault on voting and civil rights in the U.S., spoke at the demonstration. The route recreates the march that took place 47 years ago and recalls Bloody Sunday in March 1965 when people were attacked by clubs, police dogs, and tear gas as they tried to cross a bridge in Selma and continue on to the state capitol in a fight for their civil rights. Speaking to the relevance of the march, Chris Kennedy, the CWA's human rights director, stated that, quote, "Alabama enacted the nation's most vicious anti-immigrant law last year, making it a crime to be in the state as an undocumented worker. Parents are afraid to send their children to school, police can demand proof of immigration status at any time, and the law deprives immigrants, many of whom are working long hours at low wages, of any legal protection against abuse. Alabama lawmakers also approved new measures that will suppress voting, especially among the elderly, students, low-income workers, and people of color. Voter suppression efforts are underway in at least 38 states."
According to a report authored by Emmanuel Saez, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, nearly 93% of economic gains made from 2009 to 2010 went to the wealthiest 1% of Americans. During the worst of the recession, between 2007 and 2009, average real income per family declined by over 17%, the largest two-year drop since the Great Depression. The report, titled "Striking It Richer: The Evolution of Top Incomes in the United States," uncovers a number of startling facts about the worsening income gap in the U.S. In 2010, average real income per family grew by 2.3%, but the gains were unevenly distributed. Whereas incomes for most American families grew by only 0.2%, the top 1% of Americans experienced an 11% growth in incomes. In other words, the top 1% captured 93% of the income gains during the first year of the so-called economic recovery. Such inequalities and growing disparities between the wealthiest Americans and the majority of the population sparked the now international Occupy movement and other forms of resistance. Over the 17-year period between 1993 and 2010, the top 1% incomes captured more than half of the overall economic growth of real incomes per family. Writing for the Huffington Post, Alexander Eichler observes that, quote, "Saez's findings suggest that even though the recession dealt a blow to the 1%, it did little to push the U.S. off the path it's been on for decades, that of a vast and growing disparity between the richest and poorest citizens. Indeed, working Americans have suffered the most during the prolonged economic crisis, while those at the top income categories have seen their share of the wealth increase at historically unprecedented rates."
Can you explain a bit about this report? What does Saez say about income distribution today compared to the past century?
Well, if you look at the report, it's clear that the overall pattern of the top decile share over the century is U-shaped. In other words, at the beginning of the 20th century, income equality was roughly where it is today, decreases over time, is more equally dispersed, in other words, less concentrated for several decades, and then really since the 1970s, increases again. Between the mid-1920s to 1940, the share of the top decile is around 45%. This declines to about 32% during World War II in the United States, and it stays around that level until the 1970s. Since the late 1970s, however, we see a return to pre-war levels. In 2007, for instance, the top decile, rather the top income earners, share reaches almost 50%, higher than any other year since 1917, and even surpasses 1928, the peak of the market bubble in the so-called Roaring Twenties. There are numerous reasons for why this is, and some of these factors are addressed in the report. In the United States, there's a clear indication that the New Deal reforms of the late 1930s had an effect on the concentration of wealth. According to Saez, income concentration tends to be temporary unless regulations and tax policies are introduced that prevent this concentration of wealth from returning through various forms of redistribution. This is really what defined the New Deal policies both in the U.S. and Canada during the same period. These policies were in place really until the 1970s and 1980s.
There was an economic recovery in the late 90s and early 2000s, at least in the United States. How does the current recovery compare to this?
Well, as you can imagine, no two economic crises are identical, and the same applies to the recoveries. And what's important to note is that an economic recovery is defined really as a phase of the business cycle following a recession where an economy regains or exceeds employment levels, output levels that existed prior to the downturn. And we can see this measured in terms of the growth of real GDP, employment, corporate profits, and other indicators. So it's a very mechanical definition. During what Saez defines as the Clinton expansion, or the period between 1993 and 2000, average income growth equaled about 32%. Now, for the top 1%, income growth was an astronomical 98%, which far exceeds the 12% growth rate since 2010 for that same income category. But at the same time, income growth for most Americans grew up by about 20% compared to the recent figure of 1%. So there's a huge difference there. In the 1990s, then, the top 1% captured less than half of the overall income growth compared to 93% in the last 2 years. Even during the Bush expansion, which is seen often as a highly unequal time in American society, and it is, and really the post-2001, post-high-tech bubble recovery, when the housing bubble and the mortgage crisis was allowed to expand and grow, there was some income growth for the vast majority of Americans, and average income growth totaled about 16%. We can compare this to less than 3% since 2010. So we might ask, why wasn't there the same degree of opposition to the concentration of wealth during the 1990s compared to today? Where was the Occupy movement, for example, throughout the boom years? Well, obviously this is beyond the scope of Saez's short 10-page economic report. But what is immediately apparent is that there was real income growth for the average American throughout the 1990s. Vast inequalities certainly existed, for sure, but compared to the past two recessions, what Saez concludes is that more than ever, the gains of the recovery since 2009-2010 are experienced almost exclusively by the top 1% of Americans.
There has been much made by the Occupy movement of the 1%. Who is this 1%, and does the report go into this?
That's an important question. The evidence suggests that the top earners in the U.S. today are not predominantly those individuals who derive their incomes from past wealth or inheritance, but are rather so-called working rich. They are highly paid employees or new entrepreneurs who have not yet accumulated fortunes comparable to those associated with, you know, the Rockefellers and the robber barons of the Gilded Age. And we might include in this category bankers and financiers. And it's really, specifically, it's those who are earning over $200,000, roughly, in the U.S.
This is a look at the United States. Is there any similar research relating to Canada's 1% and the economic expansion or recovery since the recession in 2008?
Well, the best place to start is with a report published by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives in January 2012 called Canada's CEO Elite 100. And we've talked about this briefly on the show before. For the report's author, economist Hugh McKenzie, the 1% includes about 250,000 Canadians earning more than $169,000 a year, with the average income of this category pushing 500,000 per year. Now, what he points out is between 2010 and 2011, average weekly Canadian incomes fared a bit better than in the United States, with an increase of just over 1%. But when you factor in inflation, weekly earnings are lower than they were during the middle of the recession, so it's hardly a recovery. Canadian CEOs, on the other hand, were making 180 times more than the average Canadian, or in other words, a 27% increase in their compensation between 2009 and 2010. We're also seeing a higher portion of national wealth going to fewer Canadians, so there are some similarities. Between 1987 and 2007, a third of all income gains went to the richest 1%. Now, research from the Conference Board of Canada, it's a research think tank and representative organization, has also supported this evidence. In the past 20 years, Canada has become a more unequal country in terms of income distribution. The richest group of Canadians increased its share of total national income between 1993 and 2008, while the poorest group and middle-income Canadians, in fact, have lost shares. Most of the gains have gone to the super rich, or the top 20%, and this is a term that's used in the Conference Board's own publication. Now, this is a less extreme trend than that witnessed in the United States, but still a tendency towards a concentration of wealth in a smaller percentage of the population.
One last question. As you've said, the unequal distribution of wealth and the rate with which it's increasing in the United States is greater than that than in Canada. This has been portrayed by some in the mainstream Canadian press as a reason not to be too concerned, and also to dismiss the raison d'etre of Canada's own Occupy movement. How would you respond to this?
I just want to start by correcting a figure that I had mentioned earlier. The top 1% in the United States are those incomes above $352,000. The top 5 to 1% earn between $150,000 to $352,000. So I just wanted to provide that correction. I think it's significant that we see throughout industrialized countries this radical redistribution of wealth and an increasing concentration. We talked last week about the robocall scandal. We talked about a book by McBride addressing the significance of fiscal austerity and private affluence. I think we should consider this in terms of what it means for how we want to construct a political and social system. So there are reasons to be concerned. While the extreme fluctuations of wealth have not been witnessed in Canada so far, the point really for the trade union movement, for the Occupy movement and social activists is essentially to prevent that form of polarization in society and to reverse these trends and to look towards redistributive, social democratic, and if you will, a more just form of a redistribution of income.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. You can check out the report that Andrew just spoke about at www.commondreams.org. It's definitely worth a read. Stay tuned for more Rank and File Radio after these messages.
Critical Mass is a monthly party on bikes. Reclaim the streets last Friday of every month at 5:30 at Market Square and enjoy the presence of each other's company, as well as have fun riding around the city. Let's join the celebration with over 300 other participating cities around the world that spontaneously gather once a month to break free from automobile culture. All ages are welcome and costume and signage is encouraged.
Hey Maddie, what you doing?
Just trying to tune in CFRC on our FM dial.
Didn't Mom say we weren't allowed to listen to that punk-ass hipster music anymore?
That's just the establishment's way of using our role models to bow to conformity. Besides, what she don't know won't hurt her.
Cool, crank it!
You are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
This is your signal.
In the summer of 1964, thousands of American students from northern universities worked in the Deep South to register African-American voters in an effort to break Jim Crow and build the civil rights movement. When some of these students returned to their campuses in September 1964, they continued to organize support for the civil rights movement. At the University of California, Berkeley, the administration attempted to stop these efforts by banning political tabling on campus. This sparked widespread student outrage, a sentiment that was galvanized around the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. This movement built mass protests, student occupations, and strikes on the campus against the administration's decision. The Berkeley Free Speech Movement is generally regarded by historians as the beginning of the modern student movement. One of the leaders of this movement was Mario Savio, a son of a steelworker who delivered a famous speech on the steps of Sproul Hall on December 2, 1964. The speech precedes an occupation of the university building. At the outset of the speech, Savio criticizes an undergraduate student union leader for attempting to speak on behalf of Berkeley teaching assistants. Savio goes on to explain how social change can come through civil disobedience. Rank and File Radio is airing this speech in light of recent developments here at Queen's University, where the Undergraduate Student Government, AMS, is the main but not sole funding body of this radio station, CFRC. The AMS has recently attempted to restructure the radio station without sufficient input from its participants, despite promises to the contrary. These efforts were halted, but now AMS is seeking to break organizational ties with CFRC, putting this radio station, the first ever in Canada, in financial jeopardy. We ask listeners to consider Savio's words in light of these developments and what it means for democracy and solidarity.
You know, I just want to say one brief thing about something the previous speaker said. I didn't want to spend too much time on that because I don't think it's important enough, but one thing is worth considering. He's the nominal head of an organization supposedly representative of the undergraduates, whereas in fact, under the current directives, it derives its authority as delegated power from the administration. It's totally unrepresentative of the graduate students and TAs. But he made the following statement, I quote, "I would ask all those who are not definitely committed to the FSM cause to stay away from the demonstration." All right, now listen to this. "For all upper division students who are interested in alleviating the TA shortage problem, I would encourage you to offer your services to department chairmen and advisors." That has two things, a strike breaker and a fink. I'd like to say one other thing about a union problem. Upstairs, you may have noticed already on the second floor of Sproul Hall, locals 40 and 127 of the Painters Union are painting the inside of the second floor of Sproul Hall. Now, apparently that action had been planned sometime in the past. I've tried to contact those unions, unfortunately, and tears my heart out, they're as bureaucratized as the administration. It's difficult to get through to anyone in authority there. Very sad. We're still making an attempt. Those people up there have no desire to interfere with what we're doing. I would ask that they be considered and that they not be heckled in any way. And I think that, you know, while there's unfortunately no sense of solidarity at this point between unions and students, there at least need be no, you know, excessively hard feelings between the two groups. Now, there are at least two ways in which sit-ins and civil disobedience and whatever, at least two major ways in which it can occur. One, when a law exists, is promulgated, which is totally unacceptable to people, and they violate it again and again and again till it's rescinded, appealed. All right. But there's another way. There's another way. Sometimes the form of the law is such as to render impossible its effective violation. There's a method to have it repealed. Sometimes the grievances of people extend more than just the law, extend to a whole mode of arbitrary power, a whole mode of arbitrary exercise of arbitrary power. And that's what we have here. We have an autocracy which runs this university. It's managed. We were told the following. If President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, "Would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors?" That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the board of regents are the board of directors, and if President Kerr in fact is the manager, and I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials. But we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to have any process upon us. don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. We're human beings. And that brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. That doesn't mean, and it will be interpreted to mean, unfortunately, by the bigots who run the Examiner, for example. That doesn't mean that you have to break anything. 1,000 people sitting down someplace, not letting anybody buy, not letting anything happen, can stop any machine, including this machine, and it will stop. We're going to do the following. And the greater the number of people, the safer they'll be, and the more effective it will be. We're going, once again, to march up to the second floor of Sproul Hall. And we're going to conduct our lives for a while in the second floor of Sproul Hall. We'll show movies, for example. We tried to get Un Chant d'Amour. Unfortunately, that's tied up in the court because of a lot of squeamish moral mothers for a moral America and other people on the outside. The same people who get all their ideas out of the San Francisco Examiner. Sad, sad. But Mr. Landau has gotten us some other films. Likewise, we'll do something which hasn't occurred at this university in a good long time. We're going to have real classes up there. There are going to be freedom schools conducted up there. We're going to have classes on the First and 14th Amendments. We're going to spend our time learning about the things this university is afraid that we know. We're going to learn about freedom up there, and we're going to learn by doing. Now, we've had some good long rallies. Just one moment. We've had some good long rallies, and I think I'm sicker of rallies than anyone else here. This is not going to be long. I'd like to introduce one last person before we enter Sproul Hall. Yeah. And the person is Joan Baez.
That was Mario Savio's famous 1964 speech. That's all the time we have this week on Rank and File Radio. Join us next Wednesday, 5:30 to 6 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Stay tuned.
Virgil Kane is my name, and I drove on the Danville train till so much cavalry came and tore up the tracks again. In the winter of 65, we were hungry, just barely alive. I took the train to Richmond that fell. It was a time I remember oh so well. Tennessee, and one day she said to me, there goes the Robert E. Lee. I don't mind, I'm chopping wood, and I don't care if the money's no good. Just take what you need and leave the rest. But they should never have taken the very best. One night they drove old B.C. down, and all the bells were ringing. The night they drove old B.C. down, and all the people were singing. They went, father before me, I'm a working man, and like my brother before me, I took a rebel stand. Well, he was just 18, proud and brave, but a Yankee laid him in his grave. I swear by the blood below my feet, you can't raise the cane back up when it's in the people were singing, they went.